You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Book Review. My name is Nora Ami. The Djinn Waits 100 Years by Shubnam Khan. The city of Durban on South Africa's east coast falls psychically somewhere between Miami and New Orleans. It's sugarcane sticky and portside seedy, a little glam, a little Miss Havisham. Add vervent monkeys and a turbulent colonial history, and Durban Gothic should already be its own genre. That it's not means Shubnam Khan gets to set the tone with her magical and only gently haunted house novel, The Djinn Waits 100 Years. The abode in question is Akbar Manzil, dreamed up by Akbar Ali Khan, newly arrived from India and determined to build a life in South Africa with his dismayed wife, Jahanara, who dreams instead of England. Akbar believes that beauty is not a need but an ecstasy, and his grand folly is a mishmash of influences with Gothic towers, Islamic arches, and European balconies, and an exotic menagerie in the lavish gardens, including a giraffe and a lion that roams free on Sundays. Once a marvel rising on the hill, in 2014 it's a ramshackle mansion converted into apartments for an equally ramshackle collection of Indian residents, including a pair of feuding old ladies, a faded glamorous pianist, the mild landlord, doctor, who worked in war zones, and Pinky, who is obsessed with romantic Bollywood movies. Taking residence are new arrivals, the recently widowed Bilal and his bookish teenage daughter, Sana. In trying to find a girl-shaped place for herself, Sana stumbles on a hidden bedroom and a lost diary about a doomed romance that might unravel everything in both timelines. The diarist is Mina, a factory worker who captured Akbar's imagination and threw the household into tumult when reluctantly brought in as his second wife. All the residents are in some way haunted, but there are actual supernatural provoquants, too. Sana is tormented by the ghost of her once conjoined twin sister, who died after the surgery to separate them, and who reappears like an equally malignant manifestation of teenage self-loathing to voice her ugliest thoughts and ideations. This ghost sister warns her about the djinn of the title, limping the corridors with a mangled leg and a broken heart gnawing at its fingers. It's a mute witness and memory keeper, drawn to the house from its centuries of worldly wanderings by Mina's voice long ago. "You're stirring up too many things," her twin says. "It doesn't like it." Neither does the house, the djinn's more traditional ghostly counterpart that lives and breathes. The kitchen remembers the last time music from the record player filled the house. How the crabs had burned and the end had come so quickly, Khan writes. As Mina's diary catapults us toward that mystery, the house is unable to retain its secrets or its structure. Pipes start to leak, cracks open in the walls, mold spreads, and the cold becomes unbearable. Despite the Gothic trappings, this is not a novel of creeping dread. It's rich and swoony, tilting for the ecstasy of Sufi poets like Rumi, with a wink to those epic Indian romance movies Pinky adores. Love in real life is an unpractical thing. It slows people down and makes their brains wonky, Pinky lectures Sana. Love is just for the movies. The author, like her philosophical teen protagonist, doesn't believe that for a second. The love story at the heart of the novel is grand and gorgeous and brave. Sometimes it's a little flimsy, too. One night, Sana finds Doctor watching an Indian masterpiece on his black-and-white TV called Kagaz Kapool, a meditation on how fickle and fragile life is. The title translates as Paper Flowers, an apt metaphor for the rare instances where Khan's novel, her first to be published in the United States, falters. Though name-checked in the title, the djinn has little to do. Jahanara, the scorned wife, feels cartoonishly villainous, and as we race toward parallel endings, one shocking, the other predictable, with its own kind of satisfaction, we lose sight of Sana herself. These are minor issues, however, in a novel that is an ambitious delight, with rich characters and some exceptionally lovely writing. Here's an aside you should know. Subnam Khan is also the author of a book of essays, How I Accidentally Became a Global Stock Photo, and other strange and wonderful stories. When she agreed to be photographed for an art project without reading the fine print, it launched her as the face of hundreds of ad campaigns for face creams in Turkey, carpets in New York, and McDonald's in China. A decade ago, Khan's photograph made her a sensation. I suspect her writing will do the same again. This is the start of a major career. This review was written by Lauren Books, who is the South African author of Zoo City, The Shining Girls, and most recently, Bridge. Subculture Vulture, a memoir in six scenes by Moshe Kasher. About three-quarters of the way through this new memoir, Subculture Vulture, the writer and comedian Moshe Kasher warns that, right about now, readers might want to bail and head to YouTube. He's about to explain the Talmud. Kasher, whose first book chronicled his early youth, spent many of his childhood summers flying from his home in Oakland, California, to visit with his ultra-Orthodox father, who lived in a Hasidic community in Brooklyn. He describes swapping his A's cap for a yarmulke as he prepared to live the life of Tevye the milkman for a few weeks a year. Despite his warning, Kasher makes short and only moderately sacrilegious work of the various holy texts and their significance. The Mishnah is a written version of collected oral law, he explains. It was eventually written down when people realized the Jews weren't so good at oral, he adds with, I can only imagine, a click of his teeth and a wink directed to camera. If that sort of joke isn't to your taste, he's right, abandon ship now. Talmudic studies a la Kasher offer the same solid balance he demonstrates throughout the book. You'll probably learn something and laugh in roughly equal measure, unless you've lived an identical life to his, which seems statistically impossible. In Subculture Vulture, Kasher details his experiences within six distinct communities. First comes his account of growing up in Young People's Alcoholics Anonymous, after landing in rehab at the age of 13. Later, he immerses himself in sober partying and drug selling within San Francisco's rave scene. He parlays his experience as a child of deaf adults in a years-long career as a professional sign language interpreter, before a stint manning the entrance at Burning Man, and ultimately, a career in comedy. And of course, there's his time in Brooklyn. These abridged accounts of his life serve as part history lesson, part stand-up set, and often part love letter. My mother loves masturbation. It's her kind of thing, farting and masturbation, he writes in the chapter about deafness. Kasher spares no details of her fondness for a particularly loud vibrator or her unabashed flatulence, neither of which, he reminds us, his mother can hear. He describes being the hearing child of two deaf parents as a non-consensual sign language interpretation internship program. Still, by the chapter's end, Kasher's fondness for his mother and the deaf community is unmistakable. It's here that Kasher's research shines through, revealing detailed histories that might surprise readers who, for example, know Alexander Graham Bell only as the inventor of the modern telephone, and not as the villain Kasher depicts with such color that you'll want to write to textbook publishers everywhere, demanding that they correct the record. Kasher's ability to blend humor with homework works almost too well. You might find yourself asking, that can't be true, right? And on some occasions, the answer is indeed no, though Kasher notes when this is the case. For instance, after giving a particularly graphic description of an AA founder's penis. I'm allowed to do whatever I want and no review board will ever come for my tenure or call me out for academic censure, he jokes, granting himself just enough comedic license to make you wonder what else Kasher might have fudged for a laugh. In fairness, there's a lengthy list of research materials and fact checkers listed in the sourcing section at the end of the book. But hey, did you think you were going to genuinely chuckle your way through a straight Talmud lesson? For that, I imagine, you could just watch some YouTube videos. This review was written by Madison Malone Kircher, who is a Times reporter covering internet culture. Good Material by Dolly Alderton. Andy, the 35-year-old struggling comedian who narrates most of Dolly Alderton's new novel, Good Material, has been freshly dumped by his ex, Jen, for mysterious reasons. Like Rob in Nick Hornsby's High Fidelity, an obvious inspiration, Andy knows his relationship had its problems. He's even compiled a list of Jen's faults, including lingered too long in museums, where he once saw her nod respectfully at a tiny jade spoon. It doesn't soothe his heartbreak. Andy is obsessed with working out what went wrong. In the process, maybe he can get to the bottom of why the rest of his life has derailed, too. Alderton is a cultural phenomenon in the UK, but she has yet to reach the same degree of fame in the US, even though her coming-of-age memoir, Everything I Know About Love, has spent weeks on the New York Times bestseller list and is the basis of the TV series of the same name. Good Material, her second novel and the first she's written from the perspective of a man, delivers the most delightful aspects of classic romantic comedy, snappy dialogue, realistic relationship dynamics, humorous meet-cutes and misunderstandings, and leaves behind the cliched gender roles and traditional marriage plot. Andy, described by one character as a shambolic overgrown schoolboy, can't get his agent to call him back. Too broke to live by himself in London, he's moved in with a 78-year-old conspiracy theorist who has a parasocial relationship with Julian Assange. His friends won't meet for impromptu drinks because they have to get up early and take care of their children. And then, of course, there's Jen, who broke up with him seemingly out of nowhere. And for most of the book, we can only guess why, as we follow along on Andy's relatably chaotic and often very funny to us rebound journey. He spends some ill-fated time on a houseboat. He dates a Gen Z woman named Sophie with an inscrutable Instagram. He goes on a grim revenge diet. He cyberstalks Jen's new quasi-boyfriend after he runs into them mattress shopping. Naturally, he doesn't stop until he's uncovered Australian tax returns for the man's ex-girlfriend's custom soap business. In Good Material, as in all of her writing, Alderton excels at portraying non-romantic intimate relationships with tenderness and authenticity. Andy struggles to be emotionally vulnerable with his male friends and laments his inability to express his feelings as articulately as the women in his life. They sound like listening to an orchestra perform while he hoots along tunelessly like a grade one record player. He is often at his best friend's house with his wife and kids. If Andy were feeling ungenerous, he admits, it would be easy to feel resentful that there is rarely any effort to suggest a plan other than me slotting into their lives. But the truth is, he's desperate for a home of his own, filled with warm laundry and just-cooked lasagna. I found it a bit cringe, Sophie's favorite adjective, that otherwise true-to-life characters kept coining aphorisms like the flip, referring to the shift of power from one person in a relationship to the other. Alderton deserves comparisons to rom-com legends like Hornby and her idol, Nora Ephron. She doesn't need to try so hard. At the end of the book, Alderton further subverts the form by giving Jen the last word. She's made her own breakup list, and it turns out that Andy is a museum mansplainer, among worst faults. Neither Jen nor Andy is perfect, but Jen's illuminating perspective reminds the reader of the socialized gender dynamics that are impossible to escape in heterosexual relationships, ones that are damaging to both parties, but especially unfair to women. This review was written by Katie J.M. Baker. She is a correspondent for The Times. How We Named the Stars by Andreas N. Ordorica. Andreas N. Ordorica's debut novel, How We Named the Stars, begins with a crushing declaration. Sam's dead. It's an opening that colors everything to come, including a loss that will reverberate across every page of this meditative and tender book. The novel follows Daniel de la Luna, a Mexican-American student at a fictional college in Ithaca, New York, as he recounts the events of his first year at school. When we meet Daniel, he is quiet, nerdy, and prone to self-doubt. His freshman year roommate, Sam, is almost his complete opposite. Sporty, confident, wealthy, and popular. On the surface, he resembles the type of boy who would have tormented Daniel in high school. But Sam is different, Daniel realizes. From the moment they meet, Sam is nothing but warm-hearted, and Daniel cannot help developing a starry-eyed crush on him. Navigating this new connection is difficult and confusing for Daniel. He can't seem to pin down Sam's sexuality, and on the chance Sam is attracted to men, is he attracted to Daniel? Daniel makes assumptions about Sam's heteronormativity based on his roommate's interest in sports and frats, but Daniel also notices that there is an intimacy between him and Sam, evident in passing but cherished moments, like when Sam pulls Daniel in to dance during a crowded party. In the first half of the novel, Daniel feels the boundary between friendship and romance blurring, but that raises new questions. What are Sam and Daniel to each other? What will it take for their bond to last? Are they ready to face the challenges necessary for it to grow? Then the school year ends, and over the summer, Daniel plans to visit his grandfather, who has returned to his family's ancestral home in Chihuahua, Mexico. On the way there, he receives an email that unsettles his relationship with Sam and sends him reeling. It sets the stage for yet another period of existential searching. As he finds himself caught in a competing romance, hears more about his family history, and learns more about an uncle who died tragically before Daniel was born. At its core, How We Named the Stars is a touching story about a transformative queer romance. Daniel's relationship with Sam guides him as he reckons with his identity, with his sexuality, with young love, and with loss. Ordorica constructs the world of the novel with unrelenting care, weaving together the beauty of love with the beauty of the natural world. "You stood there looking toward me, your back to the lake," Daniel recalls, "and for a moment your blue eyes and the sky and the water all melded together into a whirlpool of my longing." Ordorica's use of nature as a metaphor throughout the story imbues the novel with a palpable sense of affection and profundity. The nature metaphor isn't the only symbolism in the book. The chapters begin with italicized text signed by a mysterious DM. Each snippet hints at DM's own queerness, and readers come to realize that these are journal entries from Daniel's late uncle, who also faced difficulty when grappling with his sexuality. At first, DM's narrative floats above the story, appearing as epigraphs that act as thematic mirrors to episodes in Daniel's life. But later in the novel, as Daniel learns more from his grandfather about his uncle's life and death, DM's history directly intersects with Daniel's journey. By lacing together these two lives, Ordorica presents a powerful argument about the relationship between inheritance and self-discovery. Though How We Named the Stars tackles heavy subjects, including death, the story is not a tragedy. Even in moments of strife, resentment is absent. Conflict is always coupled with forgiveness. Rather than surrendering to hardship, Ordorica's novel basks in love's everlasting promise. Because for Daniel and Sam, that love is kind, it is honest, and it is infinite. This review was written by Maxwell Gilmer, who is a writer based in Ithaca, New York. Last Acts by Alexander Sammartino. Alexander Sammartino's exceptional, hilarious debut novel, Last Acts, is the tale of two salesmen in Phoenix, David Rizzo and his estranged son, Nick. Both men's lives are floundering, Rizzo Sr. is drowning in debt and about to lose his firearms store because of several failed money-making and promotional schemes. His son has drifted from a gig economy career as a digital marketer to become a full-time heroin addict. As the book opens, David is on his way to a meeting with a real estate tycoon who might be willing to purchase his store before it's foreclosed on, when he gets a call from his son. Nick is in the hospital, recovering after a brush with death from an overdose. More than a year has passed since they last saw each other, but Nick has nowhere else to turn. Thrown unwillingly together, the pair embark on a plan to save the father's business, which will take them on a merry-go-round of success and disaster. Sammartino switches perspectives between this odd couple. The father, a lifelong wheeler-dealer who has sold cars, never dulling knives door-to-door, recyclable IV bags to hospitals, and Shasta jacuzzis to hotels, is an eagerly self-deluding Willie Loman-esque optimist soaked in flop sweat, whose fondest hope is to be more than another guy whose life came up soul-crushingly short. The son, meanwhile, is possessed by an ineffable, listless sadness, staring at a search bar without knowing what to type, and churning out internet promotional copy for small businesses like Pretty Paws Doggy Treats and Phoenix Home Hospice. Dying is hard, we make it easy. But like his father, he too has a dreamer's spirit, and he comes up with an idea for an inspirational, confessional infomercial that features his own overdose as its selling point and promises a cut of every sale to rehab centers and halfway houses. What separates us from all the other gun dealers in the desert, though, is our commitment to combating opioid addiction. I'm a recovering addict. My father, David Rizzo, has made it his mission to be the first gun shop in America that aims for a social good. So come on in and tell us your story. At Rizzo's Firearms, we're shooting addiction dead. When this unlikely advertisement strikes a chord with the gun-buying public, Nick and his father become local business celebrities. Though, soon enough, Rizzo's Firearms finds itself at the center of a circus of controversy. Given the stew of hot-button subjects Last Axe takes on, gun culture, mass shootings, the frenzied throes of late capitalism, the opioid crisis, it would be easy for the satire to become heavy-handed. But Sammartino is extraordinarily good at balancing the farcical nature of contemporary America with the complex humanity of his characters. He's also a magnificent sentence writer with a gift for pulling poetry out of an American vernacular that recalls the early work of George Saunders and a sense of the beauty in shoddy landscapes. He passed an unpaved neighborhood that, replete with scaffolding for future homes, resembled dazzling ruins. A grimacing man stood on a median, raising water bottles at the traffic. A woman in a sweatshirt pushed a shopping cart toward tents made out of blankets and parched tarps. It was the time of year when many of the succulents had pink-petaled flowers pinched between their glochids. While many novelists are struggling to figure out how best to address the state of the nation, centerless, ridiculous, and terrifying, doomed yet trivial, dire yet unheroic, Sammartino seems to have cracked the code. What he gets exactly right is the way we all keep toddling along, heads down, going to work and paying the bills, checking our phones and streaming videos to keep ourselves distracted, ever hopefully, haplessly, dog paddling against the current, even as we're borne away by the messes we've made. This review was written by Dan Cheon, who is the author of 7 works of fiction. Horse by Geraldine Brooks. Brooks's 6th novel traces the power of love between a man and a horse through the snares of American racism and across centuries. Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Book Review. My name is Nora Ami.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.